Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Greetings, and welcome to a new episode of New Books Network. Today is March 9th, 2023. My name is Joaquin Rivaya Martinez. I am an associate professor of history at Texas State University and will be the host of this interview. Today, we will be chatting with historian Rani Henrique Anderson about his book, Lakota, an Indigenous History, which he co-wrote with anthropologist David Postums. The result of their interdisciplinary collaboration is a wonderful book published by the University of Oklahoma Press last year. Good morning from Texas, and welcome to New Books Network, Dr. Anderson.
Good morning or good evening from Finland, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. So I'll start by introducing your co-writer. David Postumus holds a PhD in anthropology and is the author of All My Relatives, Exploring Lakota Ontology, Belief and Ritual, and the novel The Legend of the Dogman. He's a senior market analyst at the Martek Group. But today we have with us Dr. Anderson, who holds a PhD in history from the University of Tampere in Finland. He was McDonnell Douglas Chair and is currently Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Helsinki. He has held a position as a visiting research fellow at Indiana University, where he had the luck to work with Lakota experts Ray DeMalley and Doug Parks. He has published several scholarly articles about topics in Native American history, and he's also the author of the books The Lakota Ghost Dance of 1890, which was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2008, and A Whirlwind Passed Through Our Country, Lakota Voices of the Ghost Dance, published by Oklahoma University Press in 2018. So, Rani, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you become a historian, and were there any influential mentors or other figures in your early career?
Well, that is a good question. When did I become a historian? I don't know. I have been interested in history and cultures ever since I was a kid. I remember reading as many books on history and different world cultures as a 10-year-old. And so when the time came to go to the university, and history was the natural choice for me. And at the university, I, of course, became acquainted with American studies, which kind of enhanced my experience as a scholar. But I don't know if I had any early mentors per se, but obviously everybody doing U.S. and American history I was looking up to in a way. And then later on in Indiana, when I studied with Dr. DeMalley, that was, of course, he has been the most influential person in my academic career for sure.
Mm-hmm. So where does your interest in indigenous peoples, and in particular on the Lakota, come from?
Yeah, I think it's also somehow related to my childhood experiences. I was reading a lot of books on different cultures, and I started early on, started thinking about how differently people kind of view the world around them and how they behave differently, why that is. And I couldn't put it into words as a kid, of course, and so on. But that's been a constant interest to me, and how I think about the world, how people in the past thought about the world, and how their cultures affect their decisions. And if you want to use the word agency in past events, and American history, as I said, has always been interesting to me, and Native Americans especially. And when I was at the university and wanted to do a or needed to do a master's thesis, I started to think about Lakota and especially the Ghost Dance period. And I kind of felt that something was missing there in the larger narrative. And that was, of course, the Lakota voice on the Ghost Dance. And that kind of took hold of me for a long time. And I spent quite a few years researching that particular topic. So it's been an early interest of mine, and it has never gone away, I guess.
All right. So for this book in particular, you have collaborated with David Postumus, an anthropologist.
Yes.
How did you two come up with the idea of this book? And what was it like to work with somebody, with a specialist from a different discipline?
Well, when I went to Indiana in 1999 to do my PhD, I went to study at American Indian Studies Research Institute with Ray DeMalley, who is an anthropologist, or who was an anthropologist. So anthropology was familiar to me and ethnohistory from the beginning. But there, of course, I got to be taught by a person who knows more about the Lakota, a scholar who knew more about the Lakota than I think anybody did. So I was familiar with anthropological theories and methods and whatnot. And that's where I also met Dave, or actually I met him on Pine Ridge for the first time in 2009, I think. And Dave was also writing his dissertation under Ray DeMalley at the time. So when I wanted to write a book about a history of the Lakota, I thought, I know something, but I would like to have somebody who was really deeply set in anthropology, deeper than I am. And Dave was one of the choices, and he immediately said yes when I asked him, would you like to do this? And then we let's see what we can come up with and how we can combine my understanding of Lakota history and culture and his understanding of Lakota history and culture and his experiences on working with Lakota communities and so on. And we started working, and it took us longer than we thought, partly because of the pandemic. We couldn't do all the interviews and visiting people that we were planning to. And we were writing. I was in Finland. He was in the U.S. and spent a lot of hours over Zoom writing it and thinking about this. So it was not an easy thing to do.
So before getting into the nuances of your book, can you briefly explain to our listeners who the Lakota are and how they are different from the so-called Dakota with a D and the Sioux?
Okay, well, we can start with the term Sioux. That, of course, is a French rendering of a Ojibwe word, Nado Wesiwak, which is basically means small snakes or little snakes. And the Lakota are the western branch of the Sioux nation, if you will, or the Ocheti Shakowi, which is that kind of mythological, well, I wouldn't like to say the mythological, but a symbol of the different Sioux tribes or and so on. So the Dakota, Nakota, and the Lakota. And the Lakota are the westernmost people or have been living on the westernmost edges of the Sioux nation for a few centuries now, and a distinct group living on the plains. So maybe that's the short of it.
Right. So the Dakota and the Lakota are related, but this book deals specifically with the Lakota, who are the westernmost true, right?
Yeah, they are all related, and they have the same language with different dialects and pretty similar cultural customs and belief systems and ceremonies. And they are all considered allied, which is what the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota word actually means, is people who are allied with each other. They are all related in a way, in one way or another. So,
So what was your main goal in writing this book, Rennie?
Well, as I said, with the Ghost Dance, I felt that there was a story missing there, and that was the Lakota story. And I know at the get-go, when we started to think about this book, we didn't want to write a traditional history of the Lakota. That has been done. So what I wanted, especially, and Dave too, wanted to give voice to the Lakota people as much as possible. And as historians, ethnohistorians, we kind of wanted to delve into the culture and the belief systems and start from there. Because in the end, it doesn't matter what you or I think about Lakota history and Lakota place in or Lakota homelands or whatnot. It's what the Lakota people think or thought in the past. So we wanted to go from the start from the Lakota perspectives of land and belonging into certain areas, certain place, and tell a story from that perspective. Of course, we are non-native as well, so we cannot tell the story from, you know, as a Lakota would. But we wanted to start from the cultural and cultural historical background and start delving into sources that would tell us more about Lakota perspectives than, let's say, a letter by some Indian agent or any traditional sources. So we wanted to give more voice to the Lakotas in writing this book. And in a way, I think it was an idea that, well, we knew that it would not be a perfect book on Lakota history, Lakota culture, written by two non-natives. But it would be a step towards that, that yes, you can try to understand Lakota way of thinking, and you can base your analysis on Lakota sources, but you have to really dig deep to find them. So that's, I think, what was the starting point of this book.
As a fellow ethnohistorian, in my case, I also have a background in anthropology. As a matter of fact, my doctoral degree is in anthropology. But I have to say that it's remarkable the degree to which you have managed to precisely do that, to rescue Lakota voices and testimonies from the past and from the more recent past as well, and incorporate them into this book. I think, as a matter of fact, I think that this book was outstanding since its inception in two ways. First, because of your interdisciplinary collaboration with David Postumus. And second, because you have truly made an effort to incorporate Lakota testimonies throughout the narrative. So you have relied on Lakota voices contained in the archival records, for instance, at diplomatic encounters, ethnographic interviews, winter counts, and some of your own or more recent interviews with modern-day Lakota people. So could you tell us a little bit about your different sources?
Okay, yeah, thank you. I'm glad that if you saw that happening in the book. But yeah, we have the sources are, for each chapter, basically, there's a different set of sources. And of course, they mix a little bit. But there are the winter counts that, of course, are Lakota histories, the stories written on hide at first and then on ledger books and so on. And those are really detailed histories, but you have to know how to read them. It's not always easy, and you can't, of course, just rely on them. You have to compare, like with any sources, I like to compare at least two different sources to make any decisions how things happened or and so on. But winter counts are one, but there's also, for the early part of the book, there is also a lot of testimonies by Lakotas through treaty councils. And sure, there may have been problems with interpretation and translations and whatnot, but those are still key documents where Lakota people actually tell what they think and how they view white encroachment on their lands, or some letters that we were able to find in early times exactly telling what the Lakota think about trespassing migrants and so on. So those are kind of the key sources. And a really rich source actually are the Commissioner of Indian Affairs reports with the agents' reports, because there are a lot of stuff that are included in there of daily basis discussions with the Lakota leaders. So there's a lot of material in those, but you have to also be able to kind of see that. For later on, there's more and more letters written by Lakota people, some of them in a Lakota language, some in Dakota. We have translated a lot of those and used those, especially for the 1880s onwards. So that's a set of sources. The 20th century is tricky because the material gets to be really voluminous and there's a lot of material in the archives. So we had to kind of make decisions where to go, and we wanted to also include a lot of Lakota accounts there as well. So some tribal council meeting minutes are really rich sources for dealing with, for example, why are they building a dam on our reservation, and they are discussing that for several days on in the tribal councils. And those sources were a pretty good resource as well. And of course, as you said, we have a lot of Lakota friends who have contributed to this book in many ways and telling us how life on Lakota reservations is today, and also about, you know, oral histories, how it used to be, and all the way going back to the Battle of Little Bighorn, family stories and ghost dance and so on. So there's a lot of different kinds of sources, and none is more important than the other. And then we corroborate our sources with some more traditional historical sources. But the approach is that Lakota sources first, and then we see what the, let's say, American sources say. Not using American sources first and then see what the Lakota sources would say. So that is, I think, the approach with the sources.
Right, right. The book consists of an introduction and three parts. Part one provides a strong foundation for the rest of the book, as you offer kind of a concise but thorough description of Lakota society as it was in the 19th century, before the reservation period, right? I think actually that whole section can be used as a reference work for anyone interested in traditional Lakota culture. You've managed to, you know, compress in there a lot of data, actually.
That was actually a tricky section to write because we wanted to set the mood or set the tone for the reader so that they get, on the one hand, they get to the history of the Lakota, but also have the understanding of how the society may have been structured early on in the early 19th century onwards, and partly still is. And how you kind of need to understand that a little bit so that you understand the changes that happened over reservations and also the flexibility of the society. But that was a little bit of a tricky section to write so that it doesn't become a list of things.
Right, right. No, but I think it flows, actually. I think those three chapters are obviously essential to make sense of the Lakota actions and understand their perspective later on in the book, right? So I particularly enjoy your description of the Lakota belief system and the kinship system. So can you please share with our audience some of the ways in which Lakota beliefs or traditional Lakota beliefs are different from the traditional Western worldview or Christianity?
Oh, well, that's a tall task. But we can just say that we can start from the idea that there is no single God or God-like being in Lakota cosmology or Lakota way of thinking. There is Wakan and Wakan Tanka. Waka is all things that could be considered sacred or mysterious or beyond the understanding of a human being. And Wakan Tanka is then the totality of those things. It can be anything. It can be, as we write in the book, it can be a shooting star or a birth of a baby or some old Lakota say, there's a list in Walker book that what things are Wakan. So a toad is Wakan and so on and so on. So everything is Wakan. So it's a relationship with the environment and your surroundings that constitutes Lakota belief system. And at least in the late 19th century, some of the Lakota informants told Walker and other anthropologists about their Wakan Tanka, how it constitutes of 16 different aspects and all on them, and those can also change. So the Lakota belief system is not a dogmatic religion like Christianity. There's no firm rules how you worship or how you pray. It's individualistic and it can change. And holy men, for example, through their visions and their experiences, change ceremonies and rituals that add to it. So it's a constantly changing and adapting system of belief. And that, I think, is the major difference between Christianity and Lakota religion. And it also comes into play when Christianity is introduced, because the Lakotas can just kind of absorb some Christian teachings without forgetting their own traditions. That can be seen on reservations even today. So, and it's also the relationship with the environment and how you are supposed to be in that environment, also towards other human beings, other animals. And of course, Lakota stories explain why they are related to certain animals and certain places and so on. And this, of course, applies to other indigenous peoples' worldviews as well, not only the Lakota. But it's something, of course, that as a non-native, you cannot, you know, you can understand it and you can try to understand it, you can try to explain it, but it's really, you can't say that you should talk for it or talk for their religion. I think always feel a bit awkward talking about Lakota religion because it's beyond my kind of
right,
if you will.
So how about the Lakota kinship system and the political organization? Can you tell us just a little bit some of the key aspects of it?
Sure. Well, the key for Lakota political organization, let's say in the 19th century, the Tioshpaye, or lodge group, or a band in English. And that's a group, small group of people, usually all related to each other, a man and his brothers and their families who choose a leader, Itancha, from their amongst them, and then sometimes they are merged into larger groups and so on. But that, of course, you know, it's also a question of how to translate terms, like what is a tribe, what is a band, what is a sub-band, and so on. And so we try to explain, almost like explain those divisions away a little bit, because the Lakota word Oyate people can be applied to like a larger divisions like Hunkpapa or Oglala, and to the Tioshpayas and so on. So a neat categorization is a Western idea. You don't have to have a neat categorization, at least not a hierarchical categorization. Lakota people, the sizes of the groups or bands or Tioshpayas or larger groups change over time. They merge, they split. And there was a constant flux in the society. It was never a set deal that these people are these and that's it. It was always changing, and with strong leaders could leave a Tioshpaye and create their own, and people just followed them if they felt that they were worthy of it. So from early on, looking at European American white travelers or government officials, they tried to make neat categories of who the Lakota are. And we don't think that is necessarily necessary to understand who 19th century Lakota were, how they operated. And then there's, of course, the leadership structure. There's never one, you know, chief, although the whites tried to make several people chiefs who would be overall leaders of the entire Lakota people or Lakota Oyate. And that just didn't work. That was not the Lakota way of doing things. Although they, during the 19th century, changed the system so that like Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull became chiefs to rule over a large group of people. That was not done in traditional older society. So again, a Lakota societal structures changed, and they tried to change it too actively to meet the challenges of the 19th century. So yeah, that's, I mean, this, we could talk for hours about Lakota
social. Right. So I think our listeners will have a sense of how it worked. So moving on into part two of the book, which covers Lakota history up to the reservation period. So how did trade, for instance, or more generally, early contact with Euro-Americans or people of European descent affect the Lakota?
Yeah, that is, of course, a good question. And if you think about a time period of 100 years from, let's say, 1800 to 1900, that was, of course, a devastating experience for the Lakota. But if looking at some of the winter counts from the early period, like, let's say, 1770s to 1830s and 40s, the winter counts mostly talk about friendly relationships, about trade, acquiring guns, utensils, and so on from the traders. And there are incidents between Lakota and traders or whites in general are rare at this early period. But trade, of course, affected the Lakota societies in the way that people got really early on dependent on some of the trade goods. And it kind of launched a wedge in Lakota society when some of the Lakotas wanted to do the trading with the Americans, some wanted to trade with the French or Canadians in the north, and others didn't want to trade at all. So divisiveness entered Lakota society quite early on through trading with the whites. But generally, kind of bad feelings started 1840s onwards, at least if you read winter counts and some other Lakota early. We have actually one letter from 1846, I think it was, where 12 Lakota leaders sent a letter to the president saying that, hey, 1825, we signed a treaty with you guys and agreed that your people would be allowed to go through our lands if you give us some compensation. But now there are more people than agreed upon and less compensation than agreed upon. Could you please adhere to your Treaty of 1825, which is an early letter showing that the Lakotas knew what to do. And the letter is about Lakotas evoking a relationship, almost a kinship relationship with the president, who is there to provide the Lakotas something in exchange for the trespassing, allowing whites to trespass their lands. So these are really interesting relationships early on. One thing, though, that needs to be mentioned, of course, are the diseases that came along with the traders, and of course, alcohol. And there's no denial about that alcohol started to cause problems in Lakota society quite early in the 1820s, at least.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, right. Actually, I think it's interesting how these early contacts, especially in the first half of the or in the central decades of the 19th century or so, there was growing factionalism among the Lakota themselves, right? Because of the presence of the whites, because of all the factors that you mentioned. So, you know, of course, some of them better known or more popular, let's say, aspects of Lakota history have to do with the war for the Black Hills, the Battle of Little Bighorn, the killing of their main leaders at the time, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. And then, of course, the Ghost Dance and Wounded Knee. In looking at all these important historical events and processes through a Lakota lens, is there any takeout for this period, this last two or three decades of the 19th century, that, in your view, hasn't been actually sufficiently developed in the historiography before?
Well, yeah, in general, I think when historians write about the Lakota quite often, they only talk about warfare. Sure, warfare with the whites, warfare with the other Indian nations was an important part of Lakota life. Absolutely, key part of Lakota life. But there is more to that. Ray DeMalle used to always say that why always call Lakota men warriors? They were men, husbands, brothers, and fathers, first and foremost. And quite often, women are completely ignoring that narrative. We try to bring women in, not maybe in the center, but as part of a family life as well, as part of that story, which is difficult because there are not that many sources left to talk about what women did before reservation period especially. But it's also, you know, that I think we say somewhere in the book that the Lakotas too had an agenda. And the agenda was to make the most out of the situation, you know, trading with the whites and trying to keep them out of their country. So the narrative should not be only viewed from, you know, the 7th Cavalry going to Little Bighorn, but also how the Lakotas saw that, how they tried to meet the challenges and how they adapted to their society. Yeah, there were divisions, but they also made alliances and they changed their structure of the leadership. And they went to their traditions and culture. And when there was a, you know, fighting with the whites going on, they sought help from their holy man, which Oshawa Khan and so on. It's not that like the Lakotas would have been just sitting there without knowing what was going around them. They had pretty good sense of what the Americans were trying to do. And they tried their best to kind of meet that and also change the societal structures. But the traditions were so strong as well that in warfare, when they tried to make one leader over, you know, decide over strategy or something, it did not work that often. The idea of individuals trying to find glory and the battlefield just was too strong, and quite often the idea was, you know, ruined. But there's a lot of that kind of stuff that has been missing, and also that the Lakotas were pushing westward as well at the same time. They were fighting the Crows and others, and if you look at the winter counts, the longer we get into the 19th century, the further west the Lakotas are fighting the Flatheads and Shoshones and so on, going from Missouri westwards. It's also a story of trying to maintain a Lakota domain and even expanding it.
Right, right. So in part three of the book, you discuss Lakota history since the late 19th century. To what extent did the assimilation policies of the United States succeed in transforming Lakota society, and in what ways did the Lakota manage to circumvent the types of culture change that was being promoted from Washington?
Okay. Yeah. Let me go a little bit back. You mentioned also Wounded Knee and the Ghost Dance. And of course, I've been working a lot on that. And that's actually a good place where we can think about how what is missing. Especially in the Ghost Dance, the story has always been that the Lakotas tried to start a war against the authorities. Whereas I think I have in my previous books also demonstrated this was not the case. They were looking at their traditions. Again, a transforming way of looking at their traditions into the Ghost Dance, and through the Ghost Dance try to look for a better future, which of course then ends up in Wounded Knee for many reasons. But the reason, one reason is not for the Lakotas to trying to make a war. The Ghost Dance, even among the Lakota, was a peaceful religion that led to confrontation due to many reasons, which we don't have time to go into right now. But that also leads us to the reservation period. Because reservation period, of course, for the Lakota starts from 1868 for the Laramie Treaty, at least for part of the Lakotas. And the changes come through the Americans trying to impose different forms of Christianity on the Lakota and education and disrupting their traditional way of life. The buffalo is gone. There's no hunting left. There's no warfare left. There's nowhere to expand. They were confined on a reservation. And that also affects the society. The Tioshpayes are still there, but the government distributes them along different river bottoms and different districts, trying to emphasize individual persons over tribe, over family, over Tioshpaye. And that's a profound change in Lakota society. And also the men are... have nothing to do on the reservation, or maybe they do some job, take some jobs, make some money. But it's a different, completely different lifestyle. And of course, when they prohibit Lakota traditional ceremonies in the early 1880s, that's a complete cultural destruction or devastation, which of course is part of the Ghost Dance story as well. But by denying people their right to practice their own religion, they of course, or they talk their languages in schools and so on, the whole identity is lost. The culture has no base anymore. So many turn to Christianity. There are a lot of stories about, let's say, Gaul, a famous Hunkpapa chiefs, who first did not want to see a church or go to the church. But when he finally got to the church, he felt that it was good that there was some kind of religion, a way to worship again, because the old traditions were forbidden. Some of the old traditions, of course, are practiced underground or in secret, but it's not the same. There's no sun dance anymore all the basic parts of society that kept the Lakota together are forcefully taken away from them. The kids are sent to schools, and you can't talk your own language. It's hard to even imagine what that must have been like. You can't write about that.
Right.
So Lakota people have always been or played a prominent role in the struggle for indigenous rights in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about Lakota involvement in the American Indian Movement and other political activism in the last decades?
Okay, sure. excuse me. I would also like to say that writing that part three was kind of a different experience because 19th century, there are these major wars that you can write about, and it's kind of those wars and events kind of carry the story onwards, whereas the 19th century is more about economic survival, spiritual survival, resilience, revitalization of language, culture, coming
the
back.
20th, Rani, you mean the 20th century, right?
Oh, sorry, yeah, the 20th century, absolutely. Yeah, the 20th century. So we needed to write it differently. So we thought about different themes, and we wanted the theme, or it actually emerged while we were writing, is the kind of resilience and adaptation and strength of Lakota culture that despite all the oppression in the late 19th and early 20th century, the basic traditions are still there, and they just needed maybe 1970s and to kind of emerge, 1950s, 60s, 70s to emerge again to where we are today with the language revitalization and all the cultural revitalization. So that part three was kind of more of a narrative of first survival, then coming back. But yeah, okay. The Lakotas, of course, have been really well known for their resistance, both in 19th century and then participation in AIM at Wounded Knee in 1973. And that also was for us a delicate thing to write about because AIM participation in AIM and AIM actions, especially in Pine Ridge, were divisive, and they still are. We have friends who were AIM members, and we have friends there who really did not like what AIM did on Pine Ridge. And we know the political situation on the reservations at the time was very complicated. So how to write about a thing that is so strongly felt by both sides in a way, so that we would not offend anybody but still write an accurate portrayal in a historical portrayal. That was very hard, and I think there might be people who don't like what we wrote. We kind of wrote what AIM did and also how it affected societies and how it had positive things but also some negatives. So it's a mixed and complex kind of heritage that AIM left on Lakota reservations. But I don't think anybody would deny it that AIM strengthened Lakota identity, native identity in general. AIM came to Lakota reservation at a time when religious revitalization was kind of starting already. And some people actually are of the opinion that it would have started without AIM as well. But AIM strengthened it. And some people think that without AIM, the religious and language and whatnot revitalization, the strong feeling of identity would not have been the same or would have not reached the levels that it is today.
Speaking of religion, historical developments in the last century and a half or so have given rise to a rather diverse Lakota society. And one of the areas in which this diversity is perhaps most evident is religion. So can you tell us a little bit about that religious diversity and how some contemporary practices continue to reflect the traditional belief system?
Okay, yeah. That is interesting in many ways. And as I said, I've been interested in human thinking about Wakan, if you will, from a kid. And for me, I did not really understand. I don't know if I understand still, but my first visits to Pine Ridge really were and other Lakota reservations, but especially Pine Ridge were really kind of eye-opening to me, how Lakota religious beliefs can incorporate and how you can be a traditional Lakota, believe in the traditional Lakota way at the same time as you attend a Christian church. And at first that was a bit puzzling to me, but it is syncretism, I guess, is the word to be used. But yeah, the history of that, of course, is that there have been both Catholics and Protestants on Lakota reservations ever since late 1880s, 1880s, and they were fighting, last that they said, fighting for Lakota souls from the get-go. And that religious diversity, of course, is still seen there on the reservations today. But what has been happening in recent years, and I think Dave would be better discussing this than I am, because he did spend several years in Pine Ridge living with the people and doing research on this religious diversity on the reservations. But in recent years, there has been a lot of going back to the old ways. And I think one example of this is that the number of sun dances held on reservations each year has exploded. Like 30 years ago, there could have been one sun dance on Pine Ridge per summer. Now there, I think a couple of years ago, they had like 60 or so. And people are attending those. And attending a sun dance does not mean that you would not be able to go to a Catholic church next morning. And that I find really interesting. And it's also from the opposite side, the Catholic Church has kind of tried to give in a little bit so that there can be Lakota honoring songs or Lakota, Lakota songs throughout a Catholic service in a Catholic church. So, yeah.
That's interesting. That's very reminiscent of what happened with the Comanches, as a matter of fact.
Right, yeah.
What are some of the challenges that Lakota people are facing nowadays in the 21st century, and how do they face those challenges?
Oh, that I wish I would have better answers to that, but the challenges are so many. It is true that a lot of things have become better. There's no doubt about that, and I think we end the book with quite a positive final chapter. We acknowledge all the problems, but we all know that some of the Lakota reservations are some of the poorest counties in the places in the United States, and that has not gone away. And poverty brings with it, of course, certain problems, unemployment, alcoholism, drug abuse. And, of course, the issue with missing and murdered Indigenous women is also an issue on Lakota reservations. But there are some things that have changed, and one thing that I want to mention, of course, is the language. There's genuine hard efforts to bring Lakota language back from kindergarten all the way to high schools and universities. And like my friend Bob Braveheart says, that with the language, they will again have their own identity. And he says that only through our own belief in our own old customs, our own religion, our language, and the kinship rules can we decolonize. That's what he said. And that is an issue, how to decolonize when the colonizer is still there. It's easier to decolonize if the colonizer has left, but it hasn't. So I think what Bob meant with that is that by adhering to their own system of belief, their own ways of life, they can maintain a distinct cultural identity as a Lakota people, even within this colonial context that is United States. But it requires a lot from the people that are living in this setting where the dominant society is still enforcing some racist rules and making certain decisions over them that they cannot affect themselves. But like healthcare and these kinds of things have become better. And there's, of course, the energy question, food sovereignty, and these things that are really popular on Lakota reservations today. How to become more sovereign through solar energy or wind energy and these kinds of things. So, and of course, education in general. Today's youth are getting pretty good education, and they know what's out there, and they have access to all the things like the rest of us do, and they know how to maybe, I hope, in the future better find ways to help their people and get educated outside and then use their knowledge to help their people.
Mm-hmm. So how endangered is the language? How many speakers or fluent speakers are there? Do you know?
Oh, that varies. Depends on people who you talk to. I think I saw a number of 9,000 a couple of years ago, but that, of course, you know, changes rapidly. And what they are trying to do is to maybe in 10 or 15 years have a new generation of fluent speakers through education. I've been visiting Pine Ridge Red Cloud Indian School quite a few times, and they have, and I know that they have these in other on other reservations and other towns as well, like language nests where they start learning, the kids start learning the Lakota language already in you know, daycare or whatever, kindergarten, and that's amazing what they have achieved with those programs in the past 20 years. But does how fluent these children then become and how many there are going to be in the future, it's hard to say. And the elderly people who are fluent are actually, of course, getting old. So I don't know what the exact numbers are, but they are trying really, really hard to revitalize the language.
All right, Rani, thank you very much for all your explanations. So moving on, are you involved in any ongoing projects? What's next for you?
Yeah, I guess I always got some projects. We're actually working with a couple of colleagues on a book in honor of Ray DeMalley and Doug Parks, and that should be out next year, hopefully. And I'm also engaged in a larger project on Indigenous borderlands and also looking at Indigenous people and national parks through how to incorporate Indigenous voices in the park system. So there's always new projects waiting and just need time and energy. But I will continue working on these topics and always will go back to Lakota reservations to work on some projects.
It has been a pleasure to chat with you, Rani. Thank you very much for sharing with the audience of New Books Network some of the nuances of your book. Good luck with your projects, and I look forward to interviewing you again soon.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure, and I hope I got to clarify a few things. Thank you.
You definitely did. And to all of you, many thanks for listening to New Books Network. Kindest regards, and I'll say goodbye for the present.